Good morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing. And Ms. Baker Galloway, you're on first, but I have a question of Mr. Bryce that has wanted to raise before. I should have asked you this yesterday, but it slipped my mind. Are you familiar with the definition of site in the proposed district plan? Or if you have a copy, it may pay to have a look at it. It's on page 2-30.
Page 2.
Yes, yeah, in section 2, chapter 6. Dash 30 has the definition of site, and the particular part I'm interested in is across the page on 2-31. Where it says, in addition to above B, if any site is crossed by a zone boundary under the plan, the site is deemed to be subdivided into two or more sites by that zone boundary. There doesn't seem to be anything in chapter 27 which provides for that deemed subdivision to occur. What I'm wondering is if you could, it may be something that you can't deal with in the reply because it might involve substantive changes to chapter 27 and the definitions, but it occurs to me that if that is the case, there has to be some way of someone getting a consent, and it seems silly if one of the zones is rural that you have to have a discretionary consent and it's deemed to be subdivided. The other thought that occurs to me is that some of the land in the district that was to occur would become landlocked, and there seems to be no provision for that to be dealt with. The third question I have is whether it's appropriate for that to be in the definition, or should it be a substantive rule. I think all of those things need to come back to the panel. Possibly at the definition stage, and it may have consequential amendments, but that needs to come back in a way that people can comment on it.
Okay.
And I'd suggest that you pass that on to the council rather than trying to solve the problem yourself.
Yes.
I'm sure you can see those problems.
Yeah.
Well, and the same applies to C, obviously.
Yeah, that's a
It may well be applicable. It says zones, but they also, it raises the question that the ski area subzones, whether that definition automatically makes them separate sites too. But we are concerned with them this hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
I just want to comment on the answers that you provided to questions that the panel in screen 3 put to Mr. Vivian.
Right.
And you provided responses the panel, Mr. Vivian, you may recall, was unable to attend
yes.
because he was ill, but he said he was prepared to answer questions the panel may have of him.
Yes.
And we provided written questions.
Yes.
I think we may have dictated them.
Yes, I think because of the time, we just sort of
yes, I think we
recorded them orally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then we received answers through you.
Yes.
I think that it's rather unfortunate that in doing that you included answers from Dr. Court, which
yes.
we did not ask for.
No.
And I think that that was probably inappropriate. We had already questioned him and had his answers. And I don't think it was appropriate for him to be providing supplementaries
no.
in respect to those questions were directed specifically to Mr. Vivian. And I note that one of them mistranscribed one of the questions, number 9, it said, regarding paragraphs, whatever, has Dr. Court, and it was actually as Dr. Court. Had
right.
revised. So it wasn't a question of whether he had revised his position. He had revised his position in
yeah.
the question answers to us. And then in the answer that you seem to have provided from him, he's revised it again.
Yes.
And that calls into question the robustness of his evidence in any respect.
Mm. It certainly arose out of the conversation that Mr. Vivian and Mr. Court had to have for Mr. Vivian to understand the question of what had been said in the hearing. So I think I would have been remiss to not give you that information as well, knowing that that was where Dr. Court ended up himself.
Well, maybe a separate explanation.
Yes, that, yeah, probably in hindsight I could have been explained.
I think that would have been better.
Yes.
So we would have preferred Mr. Vivian's replies to come from Mr. Vivian, prepared by Mr. Vivian.
Yes.
Being you,
yes.
but not as it is prepared on a document at Anderson Lloyd, obviously.
Yes, yep, yep. No, yeah, well, yes, and he was still tapping away from home. We had a deadline, so it all would have definitely been done better, and I totally take that on board and apologise if we didn't
thank you.
Find the assistance that you were looking for.
Yeah. Okay, now we'll turn to the matters in hand today. Did you propose to take us through your submissions?
If that suits you, not word by word. Have you all read them?
Yes.
Yep, good. So I won't belabor them word by word. I'll just emphasise the point I'm trying to make at each section and then be very happy to have a conversation.
Well, could I commence then, given our discussions with Mr. Goldsmith yesterday, in which he, on behalf of his clients, submitted that the amended version of the restricted discretionary rule as circulated last Friday was satisfactory. Is it the position of your clients that is still not satisfactory, or that it still needs to be controlled and not?
We do still prefer the control framework, and as the person's the expert, so I think you'll get more of a helpful response from him.
Yes, we'll have some questions for him.
Yes, but it is, I definitely agree with Mr. Goldsmith's client that the additional amendment recommended by Mr. Bryce further reduces the concerns we've got with the discretionary framework in terms of certainty that landowners in those rural living zones have benefited from and relied on to date, and the lack of a problem with that framework justifies the change. So we're definitely getting closer, but still are of the view from a legal point of view that there isn't the justification for the change from status quo, fundamentally.
So the second question I have, which I'm happy for you to answer, but Mr. Ferguson take note because he'll be asked the same question. slightly differently phrased,
mm-hmm.
but is it the position of your clients that the council should grant every subdivision consent that comes before it?
The controlled activity?
Well, that meets the minimum lot size requirement, because that appears to be the one standard that is fixed.
In all of the zones except rural general,
yes.
excluding key area sub-zones, we say that a control activity framework is appropriate, so the council must grant consent, but in that it has, and that's the thrust of the case law aside, the council does have the ability to impose a wide, you know, has wide powers of control.
But it is the position of your clients that it should grant every consent that is controlled, that other than in the rural zone where it would be discretionary.
Yes, in reliance on the case law that says they grant consent but they can, you know, it may affect lot numbers, may affect lot sizes, may affect lot configuration, may introduce design controls to ensure there is a quality outcome.
Okay. Right.
Yes, that's right.
Well, yes, I accept that when I said this. Okay, I'll leave you to your submission.
Thank you. So,
Commissioner Robinson may have rather more questions.
Oh, good. So, in the introduction, I just refer back to our previous two appearances to make sure that the context is recorded and that the panel understands that we're telling a story, if you like, as we go along, and that, you know, for example, to understand the small part of the submission in respect to ski area subzones, it's useful to have read Mr. Hamish McCrossy's evidence on the ski area management issues and development aspirations that we're trying to make sure that this plan does not unnecessarily restrict. So that's just in my introduction. The executive summary really just gives you a snapshot of each of the submittants that this presentation is on behalf of. So, subparagraph A, there's the list of the different Jack's Point entities that have various property interests out of Jack's Point as developer. So there's a lot of them, but they are generally the Jack's Point developer, the part of the Jack's Point zone that we represent the developers for. Then there are the two ski area submitters, the Soho Ski Area and Blackman Creek, which is the first one, the one behind Corona, and Triple Crown Investments, seeking that, even though they're in the rural zone, seeking a specific ski area subzone control subdivision framework to enable the different property arrangements, leases in particular is what we're thinking up there for the visitor accommodation and the commercial expansion that Mr. McCrossy referred to in the previous hearing stream that we were here for. So that was a ski area subzone exception. And then there's the three submitters listed in subparagraph C, which come from a combination of rural lifestyle and rural residential zoning, and seeking that default controlled activity status of subdivision in those rural living zones. And Mr. Ferguson's taken on board a lot of the hard thinking of Mr. Bryce and further refined the proposed default subdivision rule, and that's appended in his appendix one. And what we've tried to do is make sure that the relief proposed by Mr. Ferguson makes sense on a district-wide basis. So even though it's in respect of our specific sites, we've tried to look at that district-wide integration using the operative plan as the working model, if you like, and modelled it on there. So what I'll do is I'll skip through the rest of that executive summary and go on to section 3 in respect of the ski area subzone point. And just drawing your attention back to the objective that we promoted in respect of the previous hearing stream, try to remind you that our overall approach is to ensure that the proposed district plan does provide for both the maintenance and enhancement of those important natural features of the ski area subzones, the landscape, the amenity values, the indigenous vegetation, So there's a very detailed package of protections presented in the previous hearing stream on those, whilst still providing for the diversification and expansion of appropriate area subzone activities, which are explicitly defined. So as long as an activity fits within that very detailed list of area activities, the rule framework that we proposed in the previous bus stream that will be complemented by the subdivision rule is to advance just those appropriate activities, and everything else falls into the next category.
I just wonder if that's quite right, because the submission merely seeks that subdivision within the ski area subzone be a controlled activity. Full stop. There's no minimum lot size. There's control is in respect of lot sizes, averages, and dimensions.
Yeah.
But it doesn't tell us anything. So, and you've just said that there'd be no reason to turn them down. So if Soho wished to subdivide into four, that would be come within that rule.
Yes, it would.
If wished to subdivide into 4,000, that would come within that rule, wouldn't it? Where is the framework that connects the subdivision rule to the package of land use provisions that I think is intended? I doubt, given the submission, that we have jurisdiction even to consider what has been proposed.
Well, that's definitely intention.
But it's not self-regulating, because there's no relationship between subdivision and land use in this subzone. I think what your clients might be better off to do is to follow the lead that Mr. Bryce has suggested, that where there is a structure plan in place, subdivision be a controlled activity, and seek to have a structure plan in place for the relevant ski area subzone, then it will automatically be a controlled activity, and there will be fair knowledge from the structure plan as to what will or won't happen. I think, and as it stands, I don't think we have jurisdiction to consider what is offered, because it's so broad, or what is suggested.
Yeah, well, we'll give that some thought. I mean, there was also the what we did originally propose for this area subzone was the ecological management plan proposal as part of the framework for ensuring that indigenous vegetation values were protected and managed in the whole.
And that would obviously form part of the structure plan.
It would logically integrate with that.
I think that needs to be a little bit more forefront of it somehow. And I don't think we can resolve it this morning.
Probably not. Yeah. But no, take your point, and we can give that some more thought and look at that integration and just check if those linkages can be made clearer. Because that, as Mr. Ferguson said, it's the intention that a function like a checkpoint zone.
I understand the entire point. I was on the panel of hearing commissioners who granted consent for the zone change, or approval for the zone change for the Porter's Heights ski field branch development.
Yeah, right.
And that provided for subdivision. But it did contain comprehensive subdivision rules.
Yeah.
So people knew what could and couldn't happen. And what's been provided in here is change discretionary in the rural zone to control.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's that means a little bit more than that.
The intention is that we can't envisage right now exactly whether we're talking about a lease for a visitor accommodation unit or it's more that the concept of leases than brand new titles, that we're using the concept of subdivision up in a serious subzone, but we also don't want to rule out.
Well, if the lease is beyond 35, any lease beyond 35 years.
Which for commercial business security and so on, we do need to contemplate that that could be the scenario. We will go away and have a look at that and just see if there's linkages that we haven't highlighted to you that are of relevance for obvious requirements that can be made.
Is suggesting that perhaps you'd be given the opportunity to file something in writing on this. If that was to occur, it would need to be by the 17th of August. That's the last day of the hearings on the screen, and we need to have them in by then. In fact, preferably few days before then, because if we wanted to question you, then we would want to see you at the hearing in Monaco on the 17th of August.
Yes, I was going to suggest that we could make it to appear in the speaker.
Monday the 15th. Yep, noon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just gives the staff enough time to distribute them before the end of the day.
Yeah.
So suppose, say, 5 p.m., then if nothing happens till the next day.
Okay, very good. I'll move on to the checkpoint zone.
Coughing quietly in the corner. Before you leave ski areas, I just put something on the merits I just wanted to explore. Obviously, I haven't yet read all the your previous evidence that you referred me to. I can understand or envisage how the ski area proprietors might want to establish further facilities and to flick them off in long-term leases or maybe even new titles or discreet activities in the ski area bases. But what I can't understand, and I'll invite you to explain to me, is why there is a need to have the same ability up on the mountain.
So what's envisaged, and you will understand more when you read Mr. McCrossy's evidence and Ms. Ferguson's evidence from the previous rounds. What's envisaged is not just the addition of, well, obviously there's gondolas already consented up the Triple Cone Mountain, and there are plans for gondolas at Soho. As well as that, it's envisaged that one of the ways that the areas can diversify is to add, in the case of the whole Catrona complex, more visitor accommodation, and that's a new concept for Treble Cone. So it's visitor accommodation, it's the commercial activities that are complementary to and ancillary to and give the visitors something to do at night. So restaurants, shops, spas, that sort of thing. So it's diversification in that, in those directions, that to remain competitive and to keep growing, to be attractive on that world market, that the ski fields are looking at ensuring that this plan, you know, is sympathetic to and contemplates.
And when you say the gondolas, they're going to be gondolas from the base?
Yes. From the road, so an alternative access up to the snow line.
Which won't be in the ski...
Sorry?
Which won't be in the skis, ski area subzone, will it?
Well, there's two ways of dealing with it. At the moment, the ski area subzone is certainly the corridor, is that right?
Well, the notified ski area subzones both triple cone and Soho come down halfway down the face to what you might think of as roughly the snow line. But the connection for example, for a gondola or a transportation link would then go beyond the superior subzone and into the regional link. So some of the mechanisms that we talked about in the Street 2 hearing were enabling of superior subzone or superior activities outside of the superior subzone, and there was a particular rule that was worked through in respect of that. And in respect of the spatial planning outcomes, there could equally be an extension to the zone itself, the ski area subzone, to provide for the outcome. So there's two possible ways in which it could be addressed.
And so just thinking about it, where I started was I was looking from the ski base up. And gondolas are necessarily going to be from the base down. And when you're talking the diversification, are you talking in anything other than expansion of the existing bases?
That's right. So for example, the visitor accommodation rule, by the time we got to the hearing, we refined it so that it was clear it was only contemplating visitor accommodation above 1,100 metres. So it wasn't over the whole slope, it was above the snow line effectively to where the gondola would be providing access, or where the current ski road provides access. The visitor accommodation is in that current node of development above the snow line.
So I come back to my original question. Is there any reason, or perhaps you can think about this further, is there any reason why, if there are special subdivision rules in the ski area subzone, they would apply outside the existing developed ski bases and their immediate environs, not over the whole zone, which necessarily goes up to the peak and covers probably tens if not hundreds of hectares?
I hope we're on the same understanding of what the subzones cover, but the subzones, for example, which triple cone do extend from a line somewhere down the slope, I don't know how it would go to the peak,
yeah,
and include all of the mountain top ski area operations that you would understand, normally to understand to occur in those areas. So the outcomes and the rules that were discussed in Strict 2 were in relation to that area, so from the ski area, subzone boundary to the top and between. So apart from the provisions which I talked about before in relation to access to the zone, so a critical part about the amendment sought to the rural area adjacent policies was that recognition of the dependency of the subzone on its means of getting access to it. So that was a policy response that was proposed to be introduced. So there was some recognition of a strong recognition of the policy that was sought between, the road network and the way we get to the zone and the zone itself. But there didn't really, it was sort of more about a transportation connection thread. It wasn't sort of thinking of anything that was bigger beyond that. So we envisaged that my business had the evidence and the rules that would apply when the ski area subzone would be limited to the ski area subzone.
I'm talking about whether there is scope for a limitation within a subset of the ski area subzone.
I'd probably like to talk to us in the cross there about that in terms of how what implications there are for the holistic plans for the mountain, just to make sure we're not giving you a premature answer. So if that could be added to the matters that we come back to you on in respect of the ski area subzone package.
I think all of that is suggesting some form of comprehensive structure plan that we work from, but might need some particular means of bringing into the plan.
Mm.
And there may be scope in your, I don't know what submissions your clients have made on the mapping, there may be scope in those mapping submissions to include that.
To include a proposed structure plan?
I don't know what, I haven't read them. But if there aren't, mm. you may need a variation.
Right.
I think the message from Mr. Robinson and I is that carte blanche is not likely to occur.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is, like we've got in the rural lifestyle and rural residential zones, you've already got a... And then this will be determination of kind of what's going to happen there, mm. and therefore controls are okay.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is you don't quite have that sort of vision of what's going to be deemed appropriate mm. up there that dovetails with the control status.
And that's where it differs from Jack's point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now that's clear. Mm, yeah. We'll continue to work that out.
Do you have any further questions on that?
Yeah. Any more ski area questions? No?
That doesn't seem like it.
Good. All right. So Jack's point, you've really got two options kind of currently on the table that from Mr. Bryce and ourselves that lead to a controlled activity framework, to Jack's points. The option that we're most comfortable with is a system that's working out there at the moment, which is as advanced by Mr. Ferguson, a control activity rule with a range of matters of control. And the alternative advanced by Mr. Bryce ties that in with the existence of the structure plan as well. We're not, and the main point of making the legal submissions is we're also quite supportive of that proposal. The structure plan out there, which will be presented in detail next year, is the result of a great deal of input from experts, planning, infrastructure, landscape, urban design, and so on. So it is a, and it's an evolution of the structure plan and an operative plan that's in the output of which, you know, is what you see out of Jack's point so far. So whether the control activity role is linked to the structure plan or is there's a list of matters of control, comfortable with either because of the confidence that we've got in the structure plan process. The main suggestion I make in the legal submissions is if you do go down that route, I think it would be useful for clarity and certainty for the term structure plan and the other terms that are used in your approach for that control activity trigger to be very clearly defined, so it's clear what is and isn't, you know, what is and doesn't qualify as a structure
plan. Have you got any
plan.
Suggestions as to how it might be defined, given that we've already asked Mr. Bryce to think about that question?
Well, only in a Jack's point specific context, because we've got it. It is a structure plan and there are the activity areas that are set out in the site standards, which probably called something else in this proposed plan. So it would not be hard to make a Jack's point specific definition, but I don't think that would suit the purpose that Mr. Bryce is using the term in, which is wider on a district-wide basis. So we aren't familiar enough with the other types of structured plans that Mr. Bryce was maybe referring to for that purpose. So it would need a wider definition of what we could provide, which would just be focused on objective points at this stage.
I think perhaps we'll ask Mr. Ferguson for assistance on that.
I'm sure he's got some ideas.
He's got time to think of it anyway.
So that's really the main point I wanted to make about Jack's points. It's working now. We support a regime that's similar in terms of subdivision, but similarly we have confidence in the structure plan as being the trigger for the control activity status as a final alternative. And Mr. Ferguson also had some, if you were going to go down that route, he also had some additional tweaks made to make that route work as well. So that's in his appendix one. So I was going to move next on to just my general submissions about the control activity status, if you've got no questions about Jack's points. And this is primarily in respect of in terms of our clients, the rural residential and the rural lifestyle zones.
Outside of the Wakatipi Basin, I take it?
Now, inside of the Wakatipi Basin, Lake Hayes Limited and Lake Hayes Stella are inside the Wakatipi Basin. Now Christina is Lenorpe. We're not talking about lot sizes, because I understand that's the matter that's deferred.
So this applies to all of the rural residential and rural lifestyle zones throughout the district?
Yes.
Submission.
Yes. Yeah. And so these are just to expand on the case law that really was addressed by Count Alpha Council in opening, just to make sure that you've got in front of you the relevant cases that expand on what a control activity means and how much control it actually gives a council to give you the confidence that the control activity framework still ensures council's got control to ensure a quality outcome. That's the gist of it. So that's the reason that those cases have been cited. I start with cases that are general about consent conditions and then move on to cases that are specifically about control activity subdivisions.
Before you go there, can I take you back to section 6.4 for your submissions?
Yeah.
Talking about the ambit of section 106.
Yeah.
Are you saying roading widths and access issues? Clearly. Within section 106, putting aside the access, obviously there must be access and it must be legal and practicable and sufficient. Can you point me to any cases that have said that a roading width is inadequate and could be declined, or the inadequacy of the roading width could be the subject of a decline under section 106?
Well, I haven't cited any, and I can't off the top of my head, but I certainly can find out if there are any for you, if that's helpful.
Well, I think that would be helpful,
yeah.
Because, well, on the face of it, section 106 is expressed broadly. I haven't ever seen it used
right.
In that way myself.
Yeah. Or even tested.
Or even tested.
One way or the other. Okay. Yes, well, yeah, like you say, we didn't, none of those decisions left to our attention, otherwise it would have brought them to your attention. But we can go back and have a specific look to that, see whether or not there are any.
Thank you.
Okay. So, you'll be familiar with the Newbury test for conditions, so I won't belabor that, but just did a quick whistle-stop tour through the case law on that. What I thought was more helpful for you really, is it about 6.14 onwards, where I start with the decision and then move through McLaren and Marlborough District Council and then Dunedin and Whangarei District Council and Mygins and Thames Coromandel District Council, where as that case law develops, it becomes apparent that the court is quite comfortable that in a controlled activity subdivision framework, you know, the decision maker can still impose consent conditions that effectively result in a subdivision that looks different from that which applied for, that has lot sizes that are different, that is configured differently, and so on. So the authority I take from those cases is that there is this, you know, you can be confident that with the right measures of control listed, council has the ability to ensure consent conditions are imposed requiring the quality outcome that it wants to see in that framework.
Now, on that score, I've a number of thoughts that I want to put to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the first is, I think the way I would summarise the test court is that it's an issue of degree.
Mm-hmm.
All of these cases talk about, is it fundamental to the consent?
Mm-hmm.
So, which is, to me, another way of saying it's going to be a case-by-case analysis, and at a certain point, undefinable in advance until the Environment Court tells us what it is, it's a bridge too far. That's the first point. So, do you think that's a fair paraphrase of the court's position?
Up to a point, there's control, and beyond that, it's a bridge too far.
Yeah, it's not a suitable matter for condition.
So I think we might be talking past each other.
My point is that whether a condition is valid,
yes,
depends whether it goes to the heart of the consent, whether it's fundamental to the grant of consent, or all these different synonyms that the court uses.
Yes.
But at a certain point, of a certain point of change from the original proposal,
yeah,
it goes to the heart of the consent, and at that point,
right,
the change is not able to be accomplished by condition,
yeah,
and it's either grant or don't grant.
Yes. Well, yes, that's right. Well, no, but you still have to grant.
Yes, if it's controlled, but in terms of the argument you're presenting,
yes,
at that point, whether it's controlled or whether it's restricted discretionary or discretionary really does matter.
That's right. And that's why it's not a district-wide rule. It's only in areas that are predetermined, and it is a bit tricky talking about this without talking about lot sizes, but you will have this conversation when the lot size issue comes back on the table.
Well, you can. You just talk about outside of the Rockerspeed Basin.
Yes.
But I mean, if your client's fundamentally only concerned about the Waikato Basin, then it's a different issue.
No, we're two of our clients are clearly in the Waikato Basin, and I can't perform coordinate with a certain change to the density rules, because I look at those as a package. We addressed density in the previous hearing stream, and lot size comes up in this hearing stream, and they work together. In each of the zones where it's appropriate to have controlled subdivision, it's in the context that suitability has already been assessed to a degree. So it's not a complete blanket framework.
Now,
so there's been that element of, not predetermination, but that element of evaluating the appropriateness as an absolute starting point of subdivision down to that particular scale.
Is what you're saying that essentially on the council should have subdivision in these zones as controlled activity. If they're not happy with the design or lot shape, etc., the council should fundamentally redesign the subdivision by way of condition until they're happy. Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't think it would be the council that does the redesigning. That's part of the pre-application and application
request
for further information process.
An applicant can refuse all of that.
They can, yes.
And some do.
Yeah,
That's the point, that at some point the council has to make a decision, and the evidence that we've seen so far is that somehow pre-lodgement discussions, the lodgement discussions, the further information, the threat to notify, the threat to use an independent hearing commissioner should somehow lead to a different outcome. But any applicant can say, yep, I'm sticking with this. The council is then faced, isn't it, with having to redesign the subdivision by way of conditions.
Yes, they would, under a controlled activity framework.
Yes, and it's your client's position that that is appropriate, is it?
As it affects our clients, yes.
And does the council have the resources and ability to do that? Is that appropriate?
Well, part of the thing we fall back on is that, in our opinion, it has worked to date. This has been the regime that we've all been working within.
I'm not sure that we have adequate evidence from the submitters that every subdivision consent granted in the district under the operative regime has been appropriate and well done. I mean, it's an impossible task for anyone to do. I don't think it's very easy to say it's worked to date, but no one is, neither the council nor the submitters, are in a position to analyse every subdivision consent and say, yes, that's appropriate. Are they?
No, no one has given you that evidence, but the flip side of that is that there is also not, in our opinion, evidence of there being a problem that needs to be fixed, that the issue that these changes to the planning regime are to address.
I suppose the other question
is not there.
There are a whole range of people, and you've referred to the subdivision consent by Orchard Road Holdings that Mr. Rice presented to us in your submissions. And there are a number of surveying firms in the district that have lodged submissions. It seems that none of those are unhappy with the restrictive discretionary activity regime proposed by Mr. Rice. Why are the clients of Anderson Lloyd exceptional?
I don't think we're exceptional.
Well, it is, because there is no one else suggesting, following Mr. Bryce's Section 42A report, that it should be controlled. In fact, it is only your clients now that they could go away.
Well, it may be so. I'll take your word for it.
Well, Mr. Geddes has filed evidence on behalf of Clark Fortune McDonald saying they're happy with Mr. Bryce's proposed provisions. I haven't heard or seen the evidence from Patterson Pitts, but the fact that they only want 10 minutes to talk to us in Waikato suggests they're not going to have substantive arguments. Willow Ridge Developments, one of the biggest developers in the Upper Kufa, they're not even appearing. They're the owners of Orchard Road Holdings who have been referred to. So, I mean, I just wonder how we put your client's position in perspective, given the position that other submitters have taken.
At the risk of repeating myself, but there's nothing new to add. For the sites where this affects us, and based on how we've seen it work to date, we cannot see the justification for the change, and as as I opened with, we've definitely come a lot closer, like the position of surprise plants at the weekends is another improvement, and we welcome that. But our main point is we're not convinced there needs to be a change, so that's our preferred position. The position advanced by Mr. Bryce at the weekend was a good one, so I don't think there's massive flaws in it. It's just that point I keep coming back to, which is we do not see the need for change in a fundamental sense from control to RD. So I can't expand on it any more than that, because there isn't anything further I can add. And the sites are, we will come back to them because they're in the Wapitiki Basin, the two main ones that are of interest to us, other than the Christina site.
Going back to your answer to a previous question, Ms. Galloway, you said that you'd be confident the ability to impose conditions with the right controls. I think I've just reread what I wrote. It's good that I might actually have written it accurately. Can you explain to me then how that juxtaposes with Mr. Ferguson's recommendations that the controls he's recommending not include controls over lot sizes?
Or is that because we've deferred the conversation about lot sizes?
No, I think that his draft rule, as I read it, explicitly deletes reference to lot sizes, but he's nodding at me. So,
I have an update in my summary of evidence, which I'll that reflects some of the further changes in evolution of thinking from Mr. Bryce around lot sizes, because his position has also changed in respect to lot sizes as well. But then it's come back to the important question around access provision. It makes some suggested amendments and deals with the concept of lot sizes as it relates to vehicle access in order to achieve adequate standards of legal width.
Well,
and that concept, I sort of foreshadow what I'm about to say, but in my summary, but I do support conceptually that change as it relates to lot sizes and discretion on lot sizes.
So I think what you're saying is that what I interpret is that the potential inconsistency between the legal and planning, the legal argument and the planning position might have softened because you've shifted your planning position to have some control over lot sizes, lot numbers. I think it's not more lot numbers than lot sizes is the real issue. So you would you're now recommending some controls, but you'll tell us the details in a moment. Just get that clear in my mind before I ask you to get naked.
I agree with the position that's been advanced by Mr. Bryce. In conceptual terms, that it is a good idea to have a restriction of control for discretion around the size of allotments to accommodate vehicle access to the appropriate legal widths, and any consequential changes that might mean for the allotments around that, and including, I think, the suggestion from Mr. Bryce to also accommodate future access needs identified in the joint plan, for example. So, in conceptual terms, I agree with and support that. But what I don't think I delve into, and I don't support, would be a restriction beyond the minimum allotment sizes on the number of lots. So my focus, my discussion has just been on the size of the lot to accommodate that need, rather than the number of lots. And that would be dealt with through the function of the minimum allotment size where that exists.
Well, we'll hold that thought until you actually give that evidence. Coming back to the legal argument, which is effectively controlled activities are a fine as long as you have sufficient controls. If so, you would take your stand, presumably, on Mr. Ferguson's recommendation is that the controls he's recommending are sufficient.
Yes, because they have to be considered in the context of the density controls and the rural living chapters themselves and the actual lot size triggers that are not complied with. You are no longer a control activity. So it has to be looked at as a package. So density controls are complied with at the land use level, and lot sizes that are still to be discussed are complied with as a hard and fast rule, and council has control over the matters listed. That is a comprehensive package.
Now, my last question about these cases is, which I read with interest. None of them appear to canvas specifically deletion of lots. Can you point me to any authority that says that it is possible by condition to delete lots from a proposed subdivision as opposed to moving the lines between them, which is what happened in Dunedin?
Yes. The only one that was the one that came closest to that was the McLaren one, and it doesn't specifically talk about deleting lots, it refers to limiting or reducing a proposal through consent conditions. But other than that, we couldn't find anything more in point. But there was nothing that also undermined the principle that he couldn't, so that was as far as we could get it. Anything else that would have shown it to you.
And so that might come under the general principle we talked about before, is that one lot in a 400 lot subdivision is probably well and truly at the margin, but 1 in 10 might be fundamental to the consent. If it's an issue of degree as to what changes can validly be accomplished by condition, deleting one lot in a 400 lot subdivision is clearly not de minimis, but not equally not fundamental. But 1 in 10 might be considered fundamental.
That's right, but in any decision that was made on that basis could be a combination of addressing access or integration or complying with the land use, density requirements or the lot size requirements. So the point at which I can't actually envisage the point at which council would have the ability, still within the control activity framework, to make that fundamental change to the subdivision that's applied for, if those other safeguards and standards are already set in the plan in terms of density, lot size and the limits of control. It would take itself out of its control activity jurisdiction, if you like, by making a decision that was that fundamentally different. So I think that hypothetical problem shouldn't occur.
Well,
the framework set up properly.
Mr. Galloway, I think you were here yesterday when I raised with Mr. Goldsmith the Larchman situation in Matthias Terrace.
Yeah.
Now that was a situation where the only way that access could have been provided to the adjoining land was by the deletion of a lot.
Right, yes.
Now that is not a Section 106 issue, is
it? No,
it's
not.
And so that is an instance where the problem has arisen. That is an indication that may occur again. How would the council delete that lot as a controlled activity?
So, I'm not familiar as Mr. consultant is about the large form situation, and for the lot that, you know, sorry, it might not be worth asking you that question because...
Well, it's hypothetical.
Mm.
You have a hypothetically, you have a site that the owner wishes to subdivide and create a series of lots around the edge with the road in the middle.
Yes.
And in the site, there is a piece of land potential for another 15 to 10 feet, 15 sites.
Yes.
The only practical access, it has legal access, but the only practical access to enable it to subdivide would be through this land, and the owner does not wish to do anything other than create a cul-de-sac.
So it has, so the other site has legal access but not practical access?
Well, it has legal access but not sufficient to subdivide. It's zoned for development. The only sensible way is to delete one of the lots on this subdivision to enable access and development of the adjoining land, which is a matter, it's a section 5 matter, the danger zone of low density residential, we should be enabling it to happen.
Hmm. I mean, that sounds like a very unusual situation, and I actually really don't feel comfortable answering it without understanding the full fact.
Well, the question is, if a landowner does not wish to waste some of his land to enable an adjoining landowner to develop their land and be integrated, how on a controlled activity application can the council require them to?
No. Well, but should, my question, and I don't know the answer, should council require a completely separate landowner to give up their land for another landowner?
Isn't it a matter of public interest to ensure that development is integrated?
Yes, it is.
And that may require that someone actually has to enable their neighbours to develop, to have integration. Isn't that the point of connections between suburbs and not just having one main road but a whole series of cul-de-sacs of them?
That's just a point of China. For that theoretical situation, from what I understand, is that dependent on acquiring piece of land to make that connection? In which case, if that was beyond the application side, then the position of the council and that would be no ability to enforce the conditions beyond the size of the application anyway, regardless of the status of the activity.
It's
either something that the two private landowners have to resolve, or that the council needs to create a legal road, go through the local government process to do so.
There are a number of options, but I still don't see that a controlled activity status necessarily helps the situation, because it's not breaching any of the standards. I mean, the Ferguson's suggestion is the council should buy one of the residential sections to put a road on, and that may not be the most practical option either. There may be other sensible outcomes that are more readily achieved. Requiring redesign of the subdivision and the reduction in the number of lots. Can't acquire access in that sense. And that was a particular case where the developer said, no, we're not. The council has to pay for it and put it up there and said, no. that provision has to be made. I think it's the distinction that I'm trying to understand is whether there is an inalienable right to subdivide your own land in isolation, and that the controlled activity status is appropriate for that, or is there a role of the council in ensuring integrated and future development that serves the purpose of Section 5 that requires some element of discretion, and perhaps looking at the Act as a whole is why Section 11 is different from Section 9.
Mm. Well, I can sort of think of examples where if that had been considered as part of the subdivision for future access to other areas of land, and that was built in the subdivision process, that would have come more so. Because maybe I can think of examples, for example, that Senator Cut, where
can you say that again? What was the
St. Andrews Park at the Scout off Wilson Road, where Scout back in time now, but there's a road that connects along that above Franklin Road that goes along the high road.
Could you just move the microphone a little bit closer to yourself, Mr. Fields? And you speak much quieter than this paper go along. We're having difficulty hearing you.
And in that situation, you know, the council had provided for Hinson and Road that have been set apart on initial stages of that subdivision. I can't remember what the name of the subdivision was. And the owner of that land put in what's known as a spot strip, of course, and that was just a small sliver of land which physically disconnects between the adjoining land, such that the adjoining landowner, if they wanted to get access onto that Kingston Road, couldn't do so. Now, it's a very difficult position for the adjoining landowner to address part of their subdivision consent without making a private agreement with that landowner. But it could have been resolved at the time of the subdivision of the initial parcel of land if that forward-looking future connections to adjoining land had been taken into account.
And presumably the spike strip was put in place as a controlled activity.
I wasn't involved, but spike strips are commonly used, in my experience, to reclaim the cost of the construction of the infrastructure that the first subdivider had to go to.
That's a very charitable view.
Well, there might be other leverage that could be applied, but I mean, but at the heart of it is if one developer had to go to the cost to construct to fix the standard of road, and the standard of the road might have been to a higher standard than they would have otherwise been required to service to meet their subdivision. And so they seek to try and claw back those extra costs, if you like, from the adjoining developer, and the spot strip is one way in which that's been used. And it's very difficult to deal with the second owner to deal with that through other than through a private agreement.
So it used to be very common under the local government act subdivision provisions, I know, because councils used to use them to make sure that future development paid for their share of council infrastructure.
Yeah, well, that was the old 3-2-1, wasn't it? You didn't have frontage to a road, get a resolution from council.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted your question.
Collect my voice there.
With that example that you brought up there, I brought that up earlier in the hearings as an example where, from my memory of that particular example on Highview Terrace across to St Andrews subdivision, that both subdivisions were able to be formed with adequate access elsewhere. It was really a matter of better connections. It didn't actually cost the landowner anything, it actually cost the council a Bite strip was actually, both roads were formed right up to this bite strip, and it just sat there, fence over it, until council had to buy it out.
That sounds about right, actually. Yeah, I think it became an obligation on the council. Yeah. And in hindsight, you could say, well, you know, it would be nice for the council to have had that ability to control the subdivision of the first high-view terrace subdivision, so in order to avoid the crash of that bike stroke.
I guess just going back to your last one example, and looking at Mr. Bryce's amended matters of discretion, you could still include as a matter of control that type of matter of discretion that would have given the council the ability to control access and service easements for future subdivision or adjoining lands.
But that then brings sharply to point the fact that there is no explicit authority approving a condition that would have had that effect.
Sorry?
That brings to my mind sharply into focus whether a condition actually requiring that outcome would have been valid.
That's related to the effect of the subdivision, which
yes.
is otherwise exacerbating a landlocked piece of land. That's an effect.
Well, it's clearly not irrelevant
in the
Newbury sense.
Yeah.
It's clearly connected.
Yeah.
But whether it's it offends the rules against frustration, it goes to the heart of the consent. All of those things that we were discussing earlier.
Mm. I mean, I don't even know if that Mr. Bryce's suggestion would be even needed, given that there's already agreement that property access and roading is a matter of control. You could say that gives council control. Property access, it's not confined to property access within the subdivision. If there's a property that's otherwise going to become landlocked beyond the subdivision, that has to be a matter of which council has the ability to create an integrated solution. Submissions which I don't propose to dwell on section 32. I just drew your attention to another piece of case law that I haven't previously cited, I think, which is a local government act case of Whakatane District Council, which we pulled out of the Ministry of the Environment guidelines on section 32 analysis 2014. So that was the reason that we thought that useful to bring that to your attention. And really the point of highlighting that case is that the very starting point of the section 32 evaluation should be comparing at least two options, the status quo and a change. And it goes back to my main point to you, Mr. Chair, that the evaluation of the problems with the status quo is where we still struggle to see the justification for the change. If it's not broken, why fix it? It's that sort of glib phrase, which kind of undermines the basis of our submission. And why we, you know, as part of our alternative relief, actually sought that the operative chapter 15 be part of our relief.
On the section 32 analysis, I asked Ms. Scott this question. And she said the council doesn't have this kind of information on the kind of cost developers would bear under different rule statuses, but developers might. And I don't think, although you contrast you contrast the council section 32 analysis unfavourably as it compares to Mr. Ferguson's, but he doesn't dare to produce any quantitative analysis either. And so my question for you is, do your clients have the information to put before us about what is the difference in cost between a controlled activity status and a restricted discretionary status?
No, we haven't. We didn't consider that was an exercise, because it's such a confined set of circumstances that affect us. There's only three sites in the rural living or rural lifestyle zone.
And
your evaluation has to be done on a wider scale than that. Just plugging in three sites worth of economic evidence that's done on probably a different methodology to anybody else's, I don't think would have advanced your considerations any further. It would have been disingenuous to probably do so.
Well, I asked Mr. Brown yesterday if on a subdivision application, with all things being equal, whether there was any difference in cost between controlled activity application and a restricted discretionary application, and it was his view that there was none. Do you have any suggestion that there is a difference?
Yeah, well, Mr. Ferguson will have his own opinion about that, and that's just one part of the...
in terms of your clients.
Yeah, well, Mr. Ferguson is the expert on that, he's the planner, so he'll be able to tell you as a planner, not an expert, which I think is more helpful. But my point is, as well as that part of the cost, that that's not the only cost, there is the, and you heard the valuation evidence yesterday as well, that there is a difference in terms of the value that can be placed on somebody's land on the activity status. And that's another part of the question as well. But I would like Mr. Ferguson to answer that question from his point of view as an expert.
The main differences I would see in terms of the regime that's been advanced by the price and what's been advanced on the scope is not so much in matters of control and discretion, but the ability to decline the consent. So if the ability to decline the consent is used in a way that you would expect it to force an outcome, then that would naturally flow to me that would increase the transaction cost and time that would take the process of business consent application, as well as the outcomes, of course. And that, in my view, that would increase the transaction costs. So quite aside from whatever other commercial cost there might be in terms of the developer having to pay for whatever the holding cost they have a lot of, but you know, I can give you evidence on, but I would have thought it was natural that the process is designed to enable that to occur, would increase the transaction costs.
If you're looking at it from your perspective, and I know I'm making a presumption here, but I'm sure it's the appropriate presumption that you would prepare a very high quality application that would leave little unanswered and would therefore be highly likely to achieve consent. Is there a difference in probability of you achieving consent, whether it's controlled activity or restricted discretionary?
In terms of the preparation, time, cost, filing application? Probably not. I don't think it would be a...
No, no, my question was actually is that there's a difference of probability. On the basis that I am presuming that you would prepare a very high quality application, is the probability of being refused consent for a restricted discretionary application any different from getting inappropriate conditions on a controlled activity application?
I certainly.
And I'm putting it, a good quality application in other words.
So if there was an issue that came up from after the modular application through discussion with council or through inputs of an interested third party, for example, that would manifest its way in a condition of consent which could be troublesome, or it could be through the threat of decline of the consent in the case of an RDA regime. It just comes about in a different way because what you're trying to suggest, I guess, I think that's just happens in a different way, but the issues still remain.
And isn't the real issue the quality of what's lodged? And Mr. Peterson, you've worked for councils.
Yeah.
Not every application is of a good quality, is it?
No. I mean, that could lead to outcomes which, would differ depending on the status of the activity, but equally it could be a piece of information that wasn't known to the applicant or has come about through an aggrieved neighbour, for example, who doesn't accept what provisions of the zone provide for it. My experience shows the more of the uncertainty than anything. Now take, for example, the Albatross subdivision on Franklin Road, fully compliant control activity, but a neighbour had an interest in providing way. It's those third party interests which have can put applicants at enormous cost. It's those sort of things that despite best preparation is not really
The point that I'm trying to understand from you is whether there is any acceptance from your behalf that there are some inadequate applications lodged sometimes that council has to deal with, and controlled activity may not be always the way to deal with them, no matter how many times, how much information you have, they may not always be adequate. They may have the right lot size. A good example in the rural lifestyle zone, to be honest, is the pre-local government subdivisions that occurred in the district, the 4 hectare ones under the county's amendment act. Long, narrow sites with stretching away from the roads. Now, someone wanted to do one of those today, 2 hectares or 1 hectare. That's equally be inappropriate as a controlled activity. There'd be very little ability for the council to say no, isn't there?
I'm not sure. I mean, the quality of the application is an issue. It will always be an issue for council, but constantly dealing with it. And of course, that's the ability through the provisions now to reject applications.
Those are getting less and less as the Parliament further amends the Act. And so one cannot rely on that ability.
A failure in terms of information, I don't know, that can be struggling to understand what's been said in terms of the remedy through the status. Yes, I understand the position with respect to inadequate applications and failures in certain areas. Absolutely get that. I'm just unsure as to how that is remedied through a difference or change of status. I mean, apart from the ability just to say no, if it's been stubbornly refused to do anything, then yes, you've got that ability to say no.
Mm.
But
isn't that the point, Mr. Ferguson? There are people who are stubborn and refuse to do things, and sometimes the council has to say no. And invariably, those are very rare.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the story comes to the heart of what the evidence is that, well, if you've got some situations which I did not conceive or know about and are not capable now to be addressed through a controlled activity, then I recognise that there's limitations in what I can know. I know about those issues. The framework of the chapter 27 is saying, well, you know, the default status, whatever that happens to be, there's standards that's been applied. Most commonly they use as site standards, and then you've got further, and in addition to that, you've got the zones. So the sense of the framework, if you like, that sort of starts with the discretionary activity, but so the default status in subdivision, and it applies a series of further controls depending on what those issues are. So, I mean, I'm not aware of anything, and hence the, you know, my support and my evidence was for the default status to maintain this control activity. But what I'll observe is that within that framework, if there are issues of a particular nature that are not capable now to be addressed through control activity status, then, you know, I think it's capable now to isolate those issues that are of a particular problem and elevate those through either a separate listing of the space of activity or through a standard, or in the case of a zone or site specific, then, you know, that could be another option in addition to that as well. So I guess that I'm just not understanding the sort of the general proposition that everything needs to be elevated because of a discrete issue, is that the targeted provisions can be formulated to address those.
So I was going to ask you this question in respect to evidence, but seeing you've led me to this point, I might as well ask you now. If the controlled activity status is appropriate, is it appropriate for the standards in the plan to be rather more explicit than they are at present? Because apart from lot size and shape factor, there really isn't anything else. There are no other real standards in there to guide decision makers. Is a controlled activity, is it your view that there should be a more comprehensive set of provisions to measure an application against?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that. I mean, in terms of my evidence, I've said that while I'm not really aware of anything that stands out to me as of such a problem that generates that issue. But I would say that in my view, yes, it is capable of being, you know, extra provisions that would address particular issues if that is found through the course of evidence that you've got a matter that needs to be addressed in a higher elevation of status. Of course, that would be my evidence that you could do that. And to the extent that needs to be more comprehensive than it currently is, then yes, of course, depending on what the scale and nature of that issue is and its effects on the environment.
Well, if you've got more questions, well, take it the other way, because we've got a couple of minutes and then we'll adjourn. It might be appropriate to finish her submissions before we adjourn.
I think it's...
What was that?
I have no more questions.
No. Well, I mean, other than that, the only thing I've just drawn your attention to at the end of the bill, and obviously we don't know what it's got to cost today, so you can't put any weight on it now.
And the question I had is, even if we looked at it, isn't it going to have transitional provisions?
And no doubt it will have transitional provisions.
So it won't apply to
I just
want to
flag the direction the bill was heading in, but really my main point there is that we will all need to be live to it. If and when it becomes law, there may be a need to, depending on what the transitional provisions say, there may be a need to redress. September's getting kind of close in terms of the reporting date, so it will soon become apparent at least what direction things are heading.
I'm not sure that
we can't do that.
We need to
look at that. Yeah. So no, that was all I just wanted to draw your attention to. So if you want to have your agenda, and then we'll have Mr. Ferguson's summary on your agenda.
Yes, in that case I will adjourn until 11:50.
Thank you.